Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Wes McGowey. I'm the chair of the LGBT Forum here. Each August, Dr. Carol Fleming chooses a topic for the club to program around, and this month is Music Matters. We call it the platform here at the club. This evening's program is titled Singing for Our Lives, Music in the Time of AIDS, with John Bailey. Tonight's program is sponsored by EY and the John and Marcia Goldman Foundation. John Bailey is a well-known conductor, composer, and teacher in the field of music, art, and architecture. Tonight's program is presented by the LGBT member-led forum. I'd like to extend a special welcome to any new club members we have here, and we know you'll enjoy all the programming we have to offer. I would also like to inform our new members and remind the current members that the member-led forums are created by volunteers of the Commonwealth Club. We invite anyone interested in bringing LGBT programming to the club to participate and become more involved. More than 1.2 million people are living with HIV infections in the United States, and gay and bisexual men are the ones more severely affected by HIV. John Bailey will use his past experience and knowledge during the dark time of the AIDS crisis to speak about the power of how the power of music can create community, and it has the power to heal. John holds degrees in music from Northwestern, Cal, and a doctorate from Stanford. He was dean and professor of the San Francisco Conservatory of Music prior to teaching in the Yale School of Music, where he conducted the Yale Concert Choir, the New Haven Choral, and taught courses in the history of music. Currently, John is professor emeritus at Pomona College in Claremont, where for 10 years he was the chair of the music department and conducted the college's choral ensembles. Twice he won Outstanding Teacher of the Year, a very prestigious award determined by the student body. He currently teaches at the Fromm Institute at the University of San Francisco. He's been a program consultant for NPR and an arts commissioner with the city of West Hollywood, California. For 13 years, he was artistic director of the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles, and he's the recipient of two Fulbright research grants, which he used to study in Europe and Australia. John has performed as conductor and composer in Meyerson Symphony Center, Dallas, Carnegie Hall, Boston Symphony Hall, Disney Concert Hall, Los Angeles, Tchaikovsky Hall, Moscow, and the Glinka Kapela in St. Petersburg. He has taken his collegiate and community choruses on tour to Europe, the Baltic Republics, and Russia, and has produced numerous CDs. Please welcome John Bailey.
Thank you. I told him he could just hit me with this. I'm going to give that back to you. So good afternoon, everybody. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. When you hear an introduction like that, you feel like you're attending your own funeral somehow. It's a little overwhelming to look back on one's life. And somebody called me the other day and they said, "You're still alive?" You know, yes, that's true. And it's wonderful to see old friends here. A number of you I know from the Fromm Institute. And there are some alumni of Pomona College back there. Which pleases me no end. Today I want to sort of take you all on a musical journey back into a time that many of us experienced firsthand. I was talking to Wes at his age as a gay man. He didn't experience this incredible plague that hit our country and hit not just our community, but many communities in the world. In big time, particularly in the 1990s and into the early 2000s. And usually when we think of AIDS and of organizations that have been involved with AIDS, we tend to think of things like, well, silence equals death. We can remember ACT UP. We know about World AIDS Day. I, with my friend Fred, two times did the AIDS life cycle from San Francisco to Los Angeles, raising money in the midst of that, in the midst of that crisis. And these are the organizations that we tend to think of when we think of those who were involved in the fight and in being present during that time. But I want us today to take time and turn and look into music. And I want us to look, we're going to look particularly at my chorus, which was the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles that I was the conductor of for 13 years. And it was right in the middle of the height of the crisis. People constantly to this day ask me, what was it like? Well, I hope when you leave today, you have some idea as to what it was like. But as I look back on it, I think it was one of the great privileges of my life to be present to a group of 150 men, helping them sing through that crisis and coming through at the other end. Rehearsals, my memories are of rehearsals where people walked in carrying their IV bags, and we had a funeral a month. We buried 150 singers in about 12 and a half to 13 years. And I remember one year we organized, I said, you know, we need to get into the hospitals. We need to take the chorus to the hospitals. So every Christmas for almost 10 years, we gathered together groups of singers and went to the how many AIDS wards that there were in Los Angeles at that time. And we sang to our brothers. And we sang them really, hopefully, into a kind of peace and calm. It was wonderful to be associated with this chorus. As he said, we sang in Moscow, we sang in New York at Carnegie Hall. We made a number of CDs. I think I'd like to just share with you a little bit of a video that describes how and where the chorus came into being.
Brian Wyatt, I'm the executive director of the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles. The chorus began in 1979 with a group of 99 singers. Originally, it was started by two or three gentlemen who then thought that if they got 20 or 30 people, they would be lucky. And at their first meeting, they had 99 people.
On July 12th, in a small community meeting room in an unincorporated area of Los Angeles County, a group of gay men meet, responding to a notice in a community newspaper. Despite their different ages, backgrounds, and occupations, not to speak of temperaments, personalities, and interests, these men become the core of a group many will come to think of as a second home.
Pride makes us step forward.
Was first born in 1979, it was a huge political statement to stand up on that stage. What comes first? You know, are we first Los Angeles? Are we first gay? And we wanted to put the G word first. When I joined the chorus in 1993, John Bailey was just starting to hit his stride. We called him our spiritual leader, and that was absolutely true. John Bailey insisted that we care for each other, that we treat each other like brothers, that we love each other, and that's what gives us all that heart on stage. I think that really comes across to the audience. We love each other, and we love what we're doing, and we're by God good at it.
I come in the line of wonderful and distinguished predecessors, Harold and Jerry, and I'm the lucky one to be here to inherit and work with the richness that you see before you.
My name is. I love the title of your series, Carol, Music Matters. And I want to talk today really about how music mattered in the lives of this chorus. And I want to talk about it in sort of five particular areas. First of all, music provided comfort for our community and for people beyond it. Music released emotion for us. It was a safe place to really let go. I can remember rehearsals where we would sing something and people would be in tears, and I would say, this is the time to cry, but when we get on the stage, we're there to help other people cry. That was our job, to help us release these emotions. It also was a way to share the story of how we were dealing with this particular health crisis as a community. Music helped us share that story. It gave us hope. And finally, music really helped to create community. And it was something we sorely needed. And its community is one of the things, I think, that has outlived this particular crisis. So let's look musically. We're going to hear a lot of music for a few minutes today. And always I'm going to put text up, because it's so important that we read the text, see the text, as we're listening to the music. First of all, music in the early days, just going to rehearsal, provided incredible comfort for the singers. It was a place to come that was safe. It was a place to come where you could be who you are. And we, at the very beginning, we began to sort of look out into the world and say, what is the music that sings our pain, that sings our joy? And we turned frequently to composers like Stephen Sondheim. And this beautiful, these are all recordings, by the way, from the chorus. This from the show Into the Woods really expressed, particularly at the beginning, how alone we felt. I don't know where the rest of it went, but that's okay. I don't know whether the number of funerals that we sang that song at, And I don't know, I hope you hear the comfort in the singers' voices, and you hear the gentle holding of one another that is really there. It also provided for us a way to release our emotions. One of the poets of the AIDS crisis was Paul Monet. He really was sort of the bard of the gay community. And Paul Monet wrote a number of books, one, Becoming a Man, the story of a half a life, and then Borrowed Time, which is an AIDS memoir. And he himself died of AIDS, his partner died of AIDS, and he wrote an incredible poem. And we won't sit and read all of it right now, but I just, this was describing his partner, Roger Horowitz. And if you look at this, there are no periods, there are no commas, no semicolons. It is a stream of consciousness where he is expressing, as a poet, what it is like to watch his partner die and to be with him in that final year. So we have here, everything extraneous has burned away. This is how burning feels in the fall of the final year. Not like leaves in a blue October, but as if the skin were a paper lantern full of trapped moths beating their tired wing. And then he goes up to the hill where his partner is to be buried and where he knows he will be buried. And Ned Roram, sort of the dean of American song, who's now well over 80 years old, took this poem and set it for the chorus, for an accompaniment four-hand piano. I keep hitting this microphone. Four-hand piano accompaniment. And he sets it as a waltz, a kind of totentanz, a death dance, if you will. And it has all the elegance of a waltz, and yet it is the waltz that helps him take this poetry that has no punctuation and give it life and give it its own punctuation.
Oh,
So his story became our story. As we were able to enter into this a very difficult piece, that way of Ned Warren's setting this text, but Paul Monet's story in a way became our story as we were able to bring this alive for our audiences. It also helped us to share the story of what AIDS was. I wonder what it will be like 100 years from now when none of us is here and how this time will be remembered. It's like in some ways it's already been forgotten. One of the things that is so heartening is to look at gay men's choruses today, San Francisco, Los Angeles. They're made up in large part by guys under the age of 30, 35 years of age, who did not experience this, and yet they stand on our shoulders. And somehow, maybe, in 100 years, the music will remain to help us remember what this was like. And the music tells the story. And I wanted to create a piece of music when I was conductor of the chorus that would somehow tell our story and tell it like it was. And I hope that it lasts. So we commissioned a piece from Roger Borland, who at the time was chair of the composition faculty at UCLA. And it's a piece called Hidden Legacies, 7 movements, for the very interesting. I said I want to use, this was in the early days of synthesizers, I want to use synthesizers, I want it to have a pop feel to it. And Roger now writes about what I said like this. He says, John Bailey, the conductor of the chorus, stipulated that for this commission he did not want a requiem or a work that only dealt with grief and despair, but he wanted a work that was truly life-affirming. Hidden Legacies is a tribute to all those who are living with HIV, to those who are left behind, and to those who have offered help in times of intense sorrow. So I want to share with you 2 of the movements today. And the first one is called The Nightmare. And in it, we really hear the beginnings of the disease expressed in music. And the ability to use all of the electronic resources, which at that time were available. And we hear about patient zero. We hear about the beginning of this disease. And I mean, I can remember so well the fear that we all lived in, not knowing how it was transmitted from one person to another, or knowing where it came from. And we learn about patient zero and this patient who came from Africa and supposedly. And then we learn about how the rest of the world treated people who were gay and people who had AIDS. So hold on to your seats and listen to this excerpt. This is just the very first movement. Thank you. Hard music even now to listen to, for me, because the anger that is here and the history that we are reminded of, it stands, this piece really stands as a testament to that particular time and told our story with all of its anger. Its last movement, however, is a movement that really gives hope. I can remember people, I remember some woman coming up to me who had known me as a child in the Midwest, and she said, "Well, I just think it's really nice that you're conducting that AIDS chorus." And I thought, no, I'm not conducting that AIDS chorus. I am conducting a chorus of men who are coming together to make music for one another and for the community. And then people would say, "Well, how can you do it? How can you stand it?" And my answer always was, how could we not do it? And it was in singing that we were able finally to come to really express our hope, not only that this would soon be over, but our hope that what was happening was going to, we were going to grow and become a different people because of it. And so I love the last movement, and I want to play it for you. We sing instead of screaming. We sing past our fears and over the rage. We sing through the tears that fall on the page of notes that we see. Our voices are free to be heard. We sing this word, love. And I particularly like the very, very last bit. Then take our song of love, to make you strong and conscious of a path to choose when all seems wrong, a path of love. for our songs have changed us. Hear it. Of 40 minutes with a question to the audience is so powerful. And it did change you. It changed all of us. That crisis changed us in ways, first of all, as gay and lesbian people, all of a sudden We were out. We were present. And it was the music that helped us say who we are. But also, it has changed the society. I think in some ways, all we need to do is look around us today. Not just in San Francisco, but in Omaha, in Indianapolis, in Fort Wayne, even in Oklahoma and Alabama. What we experienced and how we were able to express it has changed lives and continues to. And it has created, not just for gay and lesbian people, but it has created communities in whole new ways as we define and identify who we are. And I want to close by sharing with you an experience that we had 10 years after this piece came out, when we went to Russia to sing in St. Petersburg and in Moscow. And I had the good fortune of having a friend who knew a very important woman in Moscow. Her name is Alla Pugacheva. Alla Pugacheva, they say, is sort of the Barbara Streisand Bette Midler of Russia, and that Leonid Brezhnev lived in the time of Alla Pugacheva. Things were kind of been turned up. She's still quite alive. And an amazing force in Russia. And he put me in touch with her. And I said, would you come and sing with the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles? There was an immediate answer of yes. I'll never forget the night before the performance. She arrived at our hotel in her white Cadillac. This is a red square. Took us to a fabulous restaurant while she smoked long black cigars and yelled at us in Russian all evening long. But she walked out onto the stage, did a short set. We accompanied her in one number. But then she came back at the end. And she sang with the chorus a song that we all know. And all of a sudden, I began to realize that people in the audience, there were 1,600 people in Tchaikovsky Hall in Moscow, all of a sudden, people were singing with us. And then I think we were creating one of the most important events for gay and lesbian people in Moscow at the time, 1999. It never could happen today. We need to continue to show the power of this community. There we are. music matters profoundly, not just in the lives of those who make the music, but those who get to hear it and become a part of the community that creates that music. I am so grateful that I had the opportunity to be present for those 13 years in the life of that organization. It was a dream of a lifetime, but I almost didn't know it at the time. When I was offered the job, I came home to my partner and I said, "I'm not going to do that." And he looked at me and he said, "Are you out of your mind?" Well, I got back in my mind, and it became one of the most profound experiences of my life. And I'm really happy to have been able to share it with you today. Thank you so much. We have a few minutes, and if you have comments or questions or burning issues that you'd like to hear about or talk about, please, I would love to hear from you. Yes?
The irony is that the Tchaikovsky Hall was named after a gay composer.
Yes.
Who was compelled to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was gay.
That's right. That's right. And we made sure to sing some music of Tchaikovsky when we were in that hall, and there were many tears from people who were in the audience. Other comments or questions? You're all so quiet. I'm not used to this. Pomona students? Hey, we've got a question. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I really appreciate when you're doing the song that told the history, and you mentioned politicians or the disease received the initials, but they wouldn't say the name.
Correct.
And that was powerful, you know, where Reagan wouldn't mention AIDS.
Wouldn't mention the word, right.
Yeah, and how the media would just use the most gory pictures, and it really, you know, affected us. And so thank mm-hmm. you for bringing those components into the piece.
Oh, you're very welcome. Well, the music will last. Even when the stories get lost, the music will last. Did any of you see South Pacific in its recent reincarnation here? And I know that Adam Gettle, who was Richard Rodgers' grandson, who wrote Light in the Piazza, he said about South Pacific and about the fact that it told such an important story, and that the people who were part of the military action in the South Pacific are almost no longer with us. But he said, but the music has stored the energy of that story. And music, when you hear it today, releases that energy. And I think that's what happens and will continue to happen, particularly with this piece of music, Hidden Legacies. Long after we're gone, it will help us remember that Ronald Reagan wouldn't say the word, and that the gay people were the throwaways, and that it was the lesbian community who came and really helped us cope, and they were present in a way that we found it difficult. Anyone else? Yes.
I just want to say that I was fortunate enough to have been with John during all of this time as a humble singer, and to go through all of these experiences. And it's weird, as a 60-something-year-old looking back on all this, we're so resilient as human beings, and our nature is to try to forget painful things in our lives. And I've done a really good job of that, as I think a lot of us have, because we have to survive. And if we dwell on these things, it kills us. And this was such a walk down memory lane, and it's reminded me of what a good job we do to forget things that are so difficult. And this opened up some old wounds, which fortunately are fixable. But thank you for bringing this, and I'm so thrilled that we have the recordings of all of these things, because I'm such an archivist, and I'm such a person that saves things and try to remember, and these are the things that keep these things alive for us.
They do. They release the energy. Oh, excuse me. This microphone is going to be my undoing. They release this energy for. I mean, I stood up here to start this talk today, and all of a sudden I was in tears. And that's, it's not just sadness. It is, there's a certain joy and pride that those tears also, but they always surprise me. It's kind of like, no, that's all tucked away here. Everything is fine. And then all of a sudden, back it comes. And this was such a powerful experience. And you in San Francisco know it as well as anyone in the whole, in the country, between Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York City. And you know, it's interesting looking, there are three former students back there from Pomona College, and it's so wonderful to see the three of you here today, and it just, it reminds me of how, and I don't know whether you felt it when I was your teacher, but, you know, how to bring what I was experiencing in this context into the rest of my life. And it wasn't just a matter of being out, it was out, as far as out, but for people to know that this was the story I was living. And you were all very patient with me. And yet I think you were aware. In your way, at the age of 19 or 20, you were aware of what was going on. And it was music that mattered for all of us. Thank you very, very much, everyone. Appreciate it.
I do have to hit the gavel again. John, that was beautiful, and thank you so much for sharing that with us. And thank you to our audience. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.